One of the things that we made time to do and pretty much everywhere went was go and check out some of the old cathedrals and churches in Europe. I moved here to Virginia about a year and a half ago, and where I moved when I first got here, Stanton has an old church. It's about 160 years old. And then the first church that we went to in Europe was nearly 1,000 years old. And so it's this whole thing of this heritage of wandering around in a building that's been there forever. I mean, we were at one point doing calculations on approximately how many generations have used one of the churches, and the best calculation we came up with was 36. And clearly, somebody laid down the plans to start this construction with the understanding that they were never actually going to see it completed, and it was going to be something that their descendants, multiple times removed, actually completed.
Hello and welcome back to the Be Unbound podcast, where we discuss practical Christian living, how to build thriving communities, and to be extraordinary at the ordinary. I'm your co-host, David Rethemeyer.
And I'm your co-host, Jonathan Brush.
And today we are rejoined by Trent Emick. It's been a while since we have had him on the podcast, but it's for good reason. He has been out, along with several other members of our team, on an extended trip to Europe. And so we got to ask him a little bit about some of the highlights of his travel, but also got him started on a topic that he's particularly passionate about. And it got us going on a really interesting conversation about churches, church buildings, and our relationship with them and with art. So we hope that you find this conversation interesting and productive in thinking through those things.
Trent Emick normally would say, welcome back to the Be Unbound podcast, and we can say that, but frankly, welcome back to the United States of America. You have not been here for a while, so we've missed you, and I'm sure the audience has missed you, because why wouldn't they? And so, Trent, where in the world have you been, son?
Well, first thing, thanks for welcoming me back. I'm still recovering from jet lag a little bit, hence the very dark circles in my eyes, but we'll gloss over that for now. Yeah, so a group of us have been over in Europe and the UK for the last 3 weeks. So we got to start out in France, go through Switzerland, up to Netherlands, see Utrecht and Amsterdam. Then we spent a little bit of time in London, got to go down into the south of the UK and wander around there, see Oxford, all the cool stuff. So it was a really cool experience and my first time leaving the country. So it was a really fun trip.
So Trent has now joined the sophisticated elite who has taken their little European sojourn. And I suspect Trent probably knew more about Europe than most Europeans over there. And so, Trent, you know, we asked you this earlier, but what was your favorite part? What did you enjoy the most out of your time over there?
There are a few big highlights. The one that I told you guys, and I'll reiterate, is we went to climb the Stockhorn, which is a mountain in Switzerland. We had a lot of fun doing that. And it's just one of those experiences where, hey, you get to say you climbed a Swiss Alp now, which is just something that they're a fairly exclusive group, I think, even though it actually wasn't, it was more of a hike and a climb. We weren't doing like any cliff faces or anything like that, but it was still a blast. Beyond that, anybody who has listened to me do a session or content on the podcast before may have picked up on the fact that I really like Winston Churchill. And so I got to go see his estate, Chartwell. I got to actually go to his grave spot at St. Martin's Church up near Blenheim Palace. Took a picture with his statue in the that's on Whitehall Lane outside of the right next to Big Ben. So all sorts of cool stuff related to him. Got to pick up a book series from him that I was looking for a while. So that would probably be the second behind just the cool experience of getting to look down from the top of a mountain on both Germany, France, and Switzerland all at the same time.
Now, well, although we do have to acknowledge the fact that we did hear that one of the primary regrets of visiting Churchill's residence is that you didn't actually get to go inside. You didn't get to see the bathtub, which it sounds like was a major downer.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, we got to at least see the view that he would have been looking at from the bathtub when he was giving dictation on everything. So we got why he chose a place at least. And we did get to see the wall that he built that's like on the property that laid all the where he actually made the bricks and built it. So Caleb and I had a little bit of fun going up, like putting our wall and being like, we're shaking hands with Churchill, effectively, you know, and touching the bricks he laid. So it was a lot of fun.
So a nameless source, Trent, sent me a picture while you were there. And the text that came with it said, first time in my life I've seen Trent and Caleb willingly pose for pictures. Space. They're running around like a bunch of 8-year-old boys at a candy shop.
I know who sent you that message. I also will not deny its veracity.
Well, maybe my favorite text that came from the European crowd, and I got a lot from various people about different things, but that one I felt like pulling out and framing. That really made my entire week. So, well, Trent's always been about the smartest person on the podcast, so now he just comes with all that European sophistication behind it. And so we thought we should talk about something to do with Europe. So we could talk about climbing Swiss mountains, and we could talk about Churchill, both of which actually would be pretty fun podcasts. But you visited a bunch of other things when you were over there, Trent, and you had some interesting observations. So tell us a little bit about some of your, you know, religious architecture experiences.
Yeah, so while we were out there, one of the things that we made time to do and pretty much everywhere we went was to go and check out some of the old cathedrals and churches in Europe. We were kind of musing over the fact that, well, personally, I moved here to Virginia about a year and a half ago. And where I moved, my first guy here, Stanton, has an old church. It's about 160 years old. I remember calling my parents when I was looking around Stanton, telling them, this is like really old church here. It's really cool. It's, you know, 160 years old. I've never really seen anything that old coming from, you know, the western side of the country where everything's a bit newer. And then the first church that we went to in Europe was nearly 1,000 years old. And so it's this whole thing of this heritage of wandering around in a building that's been there forever. I mean, we were at one point doing calculations on approximately how many generations have used one of the churches that we were to, and the best calculation we came up with was 36. And so there's something about that heritage and thinking about how long these buildings have been here. But the other thing that we were noticing is that a lot of these churches, even if they were smaller or more local things, like these weren't all just the big cathedrals you'd see in somewhere like Utrecht or, you know, the classic Notre examples. These are kind of small town churches. They were all still big and beautiful structures that clearly took several generations to actually construct and to fully develop. And clearly somebody laid down the plans to start this construction with the understanding that they were never actually going to see it completed. And it was going to be something that their descendants, multiple times removed, actually completed. And it's interesting to me that for most of Western civilizational history, that idea of saying, I'm going to build something that is about celebrating God, that is about celebrating the human creativity that we've been given by our creator, and I'm going to start it even though I never am going to actually see it realized because the work itself is good. But here in the United States, we seem to have lost that idea, and we look at things that are like a cathedral, and we almost treat it like it's a vanity project, like it's something that's negative, like it's a waste of resources that could be going to something else that is maybe a little bit more practical, but that has resulted in a couple of things. First thing, I think partially it's reducing our ability to appreciate what true beauty actually looks like and that dimension of human creativity that we get to see in some of the older countries in Europe that we don't see as much in American architecture. But it also has resulted in us being very short-sighted with a lot of the projects that we invest in, where everything needs to have a quick return that we can see in the immediate future, where we know this is, I'm putting in this effort, I'm putting in these resources, and this is going to be the immediate ramification. I'm going to actually get to see it. And so it's sort of shared vision. So I'm curious what you guys think about all that, because this is something we've actually talked about before in other contexts. And so I think it's a really fun one to bat back and forth a bit.
Yeah, before we even do that, though, I'm curious, David, your old church and your current church. I don't know what your old church was like, but I have some understanding of your current church. And so it might be really interesting to hear your compare and contrast. So first of all, tell me, I don't know what your old church is like, but tell me what your old church was like.
Yeah, my old church back in Missouri was still an older building. It's one of the older buildings in the area, and it was I think it ended up being like around 80 years old or something like that. And so it did still have like a good amount of natural wood. The main sanctuary building had like a very high, probably like a three-story high ceiling in there, but it still like was relatively simple decor and didn't have a whole lot of decor. There would just occasionally be just like some banners with scripture maybe on the walls here and there or something like that. And really a lot of like this stage real estate was taken up. There was a large cross above the baptismal, but a lot of the stage real estate was taken up by the screens for the PowerPoint presentations. And I think that what you're getting at is what's interesting is that the church that I'm going to currently does have a very significant investment in displaying beauty and displaying art. One of the most noticeable things that they have in there is that it's a newer building. They have renovated a bank building. And so it's still fairly modern. Like, it's a lot of drywall. And so like you can tell that it's not anywhere close to, you know, multiple centuries old. And yet they've taken very intentional steps in placing beautiful things around. And so the church has a dedicated art program that they encourage for their members and people in the community to contribute art that they can display throughout their foyer so that people can appreciate it. And they also have in their main sanctuary area several pieces of stained glass art that isn't actually in the window, but is just sort of hung on the sides of the walls, and just like they have enough natural light coming in so that you can see the beauty of that. And I think it's really interesting to contrast that and to be going to a church now that has such a focus. And I think that Molly and I, almost every week we've observed here some sort of discussion about beauty and how God has given us the gift and the capacity to be creative and to display that physically through what we can do with our hands, and that is encouraged and doesn't necessarily have to be vain.
Yeah, so Trent, coming back to your thought, so, you know, describe, you know, in terms of, you know, scale of 1 to 10 for beauty, 10 being the most beautiful, the outside of your church in Missouri at home. We're not trying to like bust in your church, but, you know, just, you know, objectively, was it, you know, if 1 or 2 or 3 is utilitarian, kind of, you know, steel building, great place to worship, and, you know, 10's a cathedral, where would it be?
Yeah, probably a solid 5. It was a purpose-built church, and so the exterior had those markings. You know, it had like an extra foyer on the front that was designed to be, you know, a little more beautiful, kind of mimicking a bell tower. But at the same time, we used to joke that we didn't have a sanctuary, we had a sanctinasium, because it was the classic situation where it had the 2 like basketball hoops that were hanging from the ceiling on either side that could be converted. And so they've done a lot to improve it over the years, but it was always kind of in that solid 5 spot where it's very utilitarian, but you do see the markings of, okay, it's a church, not just some industrial building.
So I think there's something interesting here. And when I was driving at there, and David, I appreciate your feedback as well, is that, you know, so Trent, if I drove past your church, would I look twice in Missouri?
And 50-50 chance, probably.
Yeah. But you looked more than twice at the old church in Stanton, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Now, the Stanton church that you're talking about has a lot in common with the European churches in the terms of its beautiful architecture, and it also has, you know, decaying flesh spiritually inside. It's an empty church that has not had a congregation and doesn't deserve one because they've long since become heretical. But the point is that when you looked at that building, it caused you to look twice. And at some level, you know, the whole point of that is that the people that built those churches wanted you to look twice. And then I guess there would be, what is the reason for that? And so, you know, Trent, you know, when you're at those cathedrals and those churches in Europe, I guess the question would be, what's your immediate thought that strikes you when you see those enormous buildings, those ancient buildings?
A couple of things. The first thing is, I think they very deliberately make you feel small. And that's particularly true with a lot of the vaulted ceilings, all the big stained glass that you're looking at. There's just this immediate sensation when you get in there of, I'm kind of insignificant, and this is pointing towards something that is much more significant and glorious than I am. And so I talk a lot about the fact that you are generally more happy the less that you think about yourself. And so that reframing away from thinking about yourself to thinking about something else is, I think, pretty important. The second thing, though, that you did hit on after you get past kind of the immediate beauty of it all is actually that bit of sadness that a lot of these churches have slid into a place where the structure is still beautiful, but the congregation is gone and the theology is gone. And so in European churches, that was something that was very interesting, particularly because we got to attend service at a couple of different places. One of them is actually historically Spurgeon's church in London. And that was a very interesting one because of the congregations that we went to, I would say it was one of the most vibrant ones. And their building, while it had a lot of heritage to it, not a cathedral in any way. It's actually more approximate to a lot of the churches that we have here in the States. A little bit bigger, a little bit nicer, but still pretty toned down, pretty standard setup. And so that was fascinating to me that while that beauty is there, it seems to, for some reason, come in inverse proportion to the health of the congregation. And I'm still working on trying to put my finger on exactly why that is and how that can be remedied.
So from a historical perspective, Trent, you know, and I don't know if you looked at this or not, so I'm putting you on the spot here, and you might have to say I'm not sure I hadn't thought about it, but what do you think the reasons were for building those churches the way they did?
Well, I think a lot of it is actually that exact first point of they were designed to make you feel somewhat small in its significance. I remember I was reading Francis Schaeffer not that long ago, and he was talking about the invention of the flying buttress, which is that architectural structure that allows them to make those big vaulted ceilings. And he was also talking about how different strains of Christianity started to emphasize different types of churches. And I'm a little bit foggy on the independent side of it, but if you look at things like the Sistine Chapel, they're very different from what you'll find in, say, a Gothic building. And you look at some of the Eastern churches, and they tend to have a lot more of like this rounded dome structure. And that tends to be a little bit more of kind of like when looking at the rest of the world holistically, and they tend to be a lot more painted ceilings, whereas a lot of the Gothic structures are a lot more emphasis on stained glass and looking straight up and that height that you don't get in some other places. So there are differences there, but a lot of it was still built around the idea of we're going to create something that is pointing towards our creator, not pointing toward us. We're going to employ a tremendous amount of creativity and problem solving in order to do so. And that process in and of itself is pointing back at your creator because you don't have problem solving and creative capabilities if God doesn't give them to you. And then in the structure itself, we're going to embed as much kind of imagery around God as possible. And the art that's defined by then, once again, going back to those vaulted ceilings, big structures, externalized art that is designed to be very striking. Other thing, they were always built in the center of community, or at least almost always built in the center of community. And so they served as this constant reminder in the middle of this of these old communities that the thing that gives everything else meaning, the thing that's tying it all together, is this big, beautiful structure that represents God and human connection back to our creator in the middle of it all. And so I think there's a few layer purposes there.
David, you had an interesting situation where I'd say your church is sparsely decorated. It's more of a simplistic, and it's not lack of, it's high quality, but mm-hmm. somewhat understated. It doesn't look like a cathedral. And in your case, I'd say that the beauty of the building is reflected in the beauty of the congregation, in the sense that you have a pretty vibrant, thriving congregation. Mm-hmm. In our area, one of the few that's growing pretty substantially, planting other churches and planting a lot of other community institutions and things like that. So I think that's kind of, you know, you said, Trent, there's sometimes an inverse connection between those two. That I've witnessed the same thing. David, your current congregation is pretty interesting in that it's the exception to that rule in many ways.
Yeah. I think it is interesting. And I'm wondering, just more thinking out loud about this, I would love to get you guys' thoughts on whether or not this strikes true to you, that if potentially the beauty that comes out in some of these church buildings in the places of worship that you have. I remember my experience. My wife and I went to Rome for our honeymoon last year, and Jonathan, you'll probably remember a similar experience when you were there, is that going into St. Peter's Basilica in Rome for the first time, which is pretty much just like the peak, the pinnacle experience when it comes to an absolutely gorgeous cathedral building that just fills you with awe, makes you feel absolutely minuscule. And my wife and I both, it was just a very huge standout experience. She immediately started crying. I just immediately thought, like, wow, I have never been in a physical space that makes me so tangibly feel like I can feel the presence of God. And even though, like, I know logically and theologically that I am no more or less in the presence of God in St. Peter's Basilica than I am in my room here in Virginia, like, still just having that reminder of that was something that was powerful. And I'm wondering if part of the kind of disconnect that we're seeing, where, like, some of the congregations that are in these beautiful buildings are ending up on the decline, is because of the fact that these buildings do such a great job of invoking the feeling of God's presence, and have just so much of an emphasis, and, like, it can be a very emotional experience to be there and to worship there. And if you are not very careful in maintaining your theology around that, can then lead to being drawn much towards, okay, I've been here for a long time. Like, you know, if you go to a beautiful cathedral every Sunday for several years, it's going to lose part of its luster. What are ways that I can continue to feel like I am more in the presence of God, and ends up emphasizing a little bit more of the emotional side rather than into the depth of the theological teaching richness that is required for a thriving church? That's just a theory that I'm wondering is true. I would be curious to hear you guys' thoughts on that.
I think there's an interesting question here between how does the building change your perception of God? And the reason I say that is that I think it's a very noteworthy that you said, I've never felt more in the presence of God, and that your wife was moved to tears by St. Peter's Basilica, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's an interesting reaction to God. And the question is, you know, how much role does the architecture itself play in your perception or understanding of God? Is that a little bit, mm-hmm. That's not quite what you asked, and I'm not sure if that's the wrong question.
Yeah, no, I think that's still accurate. I guess I'm wondering if, because, yeah, like, there is just, like, a spiritual and an emotional aspect of it, and I guess I'm wondering if churches who are in those buildings, if they don't stay vigilant, end up leaning much more into the emotional side of things rather than just letting it enrich their spirit along with the rest of the purpose of the church.
In my mind, guys, I'm like, you know, I've got the shotgun open and I, like, have dropped the shells in, and I'm trying to decide whether I want to click it shut and jerk both triggers at the same time. Like that's the way I'm trying to consider my next comments here. I think there's an American Christian idea that says that it's almost sinful to consider the building, the church is the people, and there's this, like, real American, is it Puritan? I don't know, work ethic, frugality that infects this. But, you know, the kind of, you know, pulling the shotgun up and jerking both triggers here. So I've spent all my time in Appalachia and in the South in terms of where I've lived, right? And so the amount of little churches I've walked in who haven't updated, I don't know. Let me get a little more specific. In my own denominational background, right, there is a plethora of churches who are objectively, disgustingly ugly. They they're disgustingly ugly because of neglect and because of uncaringness. They're often impeccably clean. It's not like they're dirty. It's not like they're scrubbed, but the linoleum is from the 70s. You know, there's one that I attend fairly frequently, not as a member, but because I'm there for different things. And, you know, there's bright orange cushions that were obviously put in the 70s, and they're still there. I've been in ones with, like, lime green carpets and stuff like that. And, you know, it's worse if you get in the Sunday school rooms. It's like, I joke, it's like, you know, in the Sunday school rooms of most of the churches that I attend in Appalachia and in my space tradition, there are couches and chairs that were not good enough for Goodwill. right? I mean, like, I just recently was with somebody. We toured a house that this is a business, and they had acquired a couple houses. And this house was moldering, hadn't been open for months, had a mold problem downstairs. And there's a bunch of these absolutely disgustingly nasty couches. And I was like, those things are on their way to somebody's Sunday school room. Like, that, like Goodwill wouldn't touch them with a 20-foot pole, right? But there's a bunch of congregations who are like, that's exactly what we need for our youth room. I mean, like, that's the kind of thing, right? But there's also, and not entirely, but often, those congregations have some particularly difficult spiritual and theological problems. Now, in the same denomination, in the same tradition, in the same set of mountains, I have been in churches who are not cathedrals. They're not cathedrals. And they're not ornate, because I come from a more plain church tradition, not high church, right? But they're gorgeous. They're beautiful. They're little jewels of craftsmanship, where sometimes the members of the congregation themselves have laid the floor and carved the pews and built the and carved the relief on the pulpit. And there's a simplicity to them, but the whole thing screams craftsmanship and beauty. And you walk in, and you may not be awed like St. Peter's Basilica, but you definitely look at it, and the warm tones of the wood shine in the sunshine coming through the windows, and it was designed so it picked it up in just that way, and you feel some sort of spiritual connection. And in my experience, those congregations are often theologically more healthy than the other ones. And I'm a little hesitant to completely do this, but what I'd like to say is that if you continually tolerate an ugly sanctuary and an ugly church building, there's a pretty near certainty that you have some significant theological deficiencies that are going to wind up biting you. Now, to Trent's point, I'm not entirely sure what that means when you look at, like, they're not obviously connected, because my experience in Europe, and I was there in February when I was there last, is that there's a bunch of really empty, cold buildings. And so it's clearly not the correlation. It's not build a beautiful building and have a great congregation. There's something else to it. But there is also something related in ways I think we're reluctant to talk about.
Well, and there's also kind of the other end of the spectrum, where now we have a lot of modern church buildings who are creating, quote unquote, beautiful spaces that are really just media productions and are gigantic concert venues, essentially, and are not nearly as focused on, like, creating beauty that, like, anyone could just come in and objectively look at and say, wow, this is a work of art, but it's more just, wow, I bet that there's a really great band that is highly talented and they spend tens of thousands of dollars to make sure that there's a high production value on this. And those also, a lot of the time, have some questionable theology there. So I am hesitant to draw a particularly strong connection between just how much they invest in just the overall building and that. Feeling stuck with traditional higher education? You're not alone. Many students want something that actually prepares them for life. That's where Ascend by Unbound comes in. Ascend blends flexible learning with real-world projects, mentorship, and a Christian community to help young adults thrive. From certificates to degrees, you'll gain the skills, experience, and network you need for your future. Ready for a different path? Visit beunbound.us/ascend today.
This is a thought that's coalescing in my mind currently, so bear with me as I try to actually make it come together. Thinking about this connection between the beauty of the building, the health of the congregation, the health of the theology. When we think about all of these cathedrals and these old churches that were built in Europe, and we think about when they were built, why they were built, the cultural circumstance that they were in, the circumstance of the church, it seems to me nearly universal that they were built in a context where Christianity as an institution was not under ideological assault. They were built in an environment where the church was a church, the church wasn't going anywhere, the church was a cultural and even some cases a political institution, and that could be besieged on other fronts, but there wasn't so much of active atheist or postmodern antagonism towards the church in the same way that there is today. You, of course, had other religions that would push back by, but particularly in, you know, Western Europe, those were fairly minimal. You had Islam that was pushing at the fringes, and even that was for a brief period of time. Otherwise, they were pretty secure. And so it made sense to build a building that was beautiful and that entirely pointed back towards God, because it wasn't so much of a question of do we need to train people theologically as much as it was we need to continually emphasize the importance of this in your day-to-day life and of Christianity and of God and that connection that he has back to you individually. Whereas here in America, we have more of that problem of there is an active ideological disagreements that Christianity is embroiled in, where we're fighting back against cultural headwinds that are pushing at the very idea of Christianity and its very validity as a institution. Now, the consequences, I think, of that place that a lot of these cathedrals came from and that idea of the theological training isn't as important is that when those cultural headwinds did come in, when modernity did come in and when rationalism started to take over, they couldn't hold up. And that's why so many of those churches are hollowed out now, is because they entirely focused on the beauty, and that was the only thing that they had. And so when that antagonism or resistance came in, they couldn't push back on it in any way, and so they just washed out. Whereas in America, we're still seeing that struggle. We're still seeing the church have some of its own difficulties, but it has remained somewhat untattered by those cultural headwinds that are hitting it. And so there's something there to say that there is a power in focusing more on the practical side of things. But I think what we all could agree on here is that there is some sort of intersection where you can balance that focus on building something that points back to your creator, building something that functions actually as a home for your church and as your congregation, while not allowing that to become the focus of the church. And like what you were saying, David, I think a lot of the times that we're seeing these other more modern churches are emphasizing beauty in other ways, where it's production value, music, whatever it is. It's, again, beauty for the wrong reasons, where it's turned into beauty that is self-aggrandizing. It's beauty in, hey, look at how cool we are. Look at how cool our production value is. And it becomes very internally oriented. And so the question is, what can we do to help build up a situation where we can promote that kind of beauty in a way that is pointing back to our creator, keeping that in context of that is something that is almost external to us, it's not pointing back to us, and also emphasizing that kind of theological and training and rearing that we all need today in the environment that we find ourselves in?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting take, Trent, and has a lot of accuracy in it in terms of, I think, the context of what those places are built in. I've been struggling with this ever since we started talking, and I don't know that we'll have time to fully develop this. I was curious, so what'd you say, 36 generations was your estimate in one of those churches?
Right about, and that's very rough calculation.
Right.
That was
right.
Caleb and I walking back at about 10 o'clock at night, funnily enough, to a British graveyard. Yes, we were going back to Airbnb. That's an air sword for our time.
Hey, some of those generations might have been right next to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, a lot of them were.
I remember being in Westminster Abbey. It's a long story, but I was in Westminster Abbey after visiting hours because I was with a friend who had access to play the organ at Westminster Abbey. And so this is in a different time and place, I guess. And we literally, the organist threw us the keys to Westminster Abbey. It was a big key. And was like, I'm going out for some fish and chips. Have fun. And I was like, we have the keys to Westminster Abbey. And it was, and as I say, it was my friend and I and what, like 3,000 dead people, because there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of people buried in Westminster Abbey. There's something about the idea of the permanency of the church, you know, the idea that it takes generations to build that building, right? Many of them took generations to build, and that they have existed for generations. There's a discipleship aspect of that that's pretty interesting. There's a longevity to that, you know, like, and I here's what I was kind of struggling with a little bit, is that the more evangelical the church is in North America, the more crappy its building is typically, right? I mean, like it's in some sort of, I mean, that's not always the case, but lots of time it's some sort of steel warehouse looking thing with high production values inside. And that's an interesting reflection on your evangelistic fervor, because you're basically not expecting this thing to last. Now, it could be that you're not expecting it to last because of growth and some other things. And I'm not deliberately trying to be offensive to that thing. But there's also an interesting evangelistic take on a church that was built to serve 36 generations. I mean, that's a level of confidence in the church that is not immediately apparent in today's architectural endeavors related to spirituality in the United States. And so, on the other hand, I was sort of taking, okay, well, let's look at the other side. If the church lives through its people, which we would, you know, being Reformation people, we would argue a good bit about, it may not be the buildings themselves. It may be the multitude and even the diversity of faith in the United States that winds up, you know, that's an interesting contrast, right? Europe's full of beautiful buildings that are empty. The United States is full of cruddy buildings that are full. And clearly not full as they were, and there's a whole different conversation there. But that's also a pretty interesting thing to kind of contrast and look at. And yeah, on one hand, I'd like to argue against cruddy buildings. On the other hand, if push came to shove, I'd rather have buildings with people in them, regardless of what they look like. On the other hand, we're not 36 generations deep, so could be that we end up with empty buildings or ugly. Well, Trent, thanks. We're so appreciative of having your European enlightenment to be able to come in and upgrade our humble little podcast here. It's always great to talk to you. It's great to have you back. In some ways, everybody should know that while Trent, I don't know, I'm not sure what Trent characterized this as, I kind of thought he went on vacation, but I also noticed that he didn't miss a single meeting that he would have been on if he was here. And so, but I also know the time change meant that some of those meetings were pretty unpleasant times of the day and evening and middle of the night. And so Trent was in Europe, but he was also working. So I'm not sure if he had a vacation or not. But all we know is that we're glad that he's back. We've got a lot of things to talk about. It was fun to talk about them on the podcast. And we appreciate you being here with us.
Yeah, absolutely. I almost feel like I should have opened up with a British accent. Now I'm thinking about it in order to bring that European enlightenment home. But missed opportunities.
Hey, something for us to look forward to next time.
Exactly, yeah. Do my best Winston Churchill impression?
Oh, definitely. But I skipped the bathtub.
Yeah, I can manage that.
Well, David, that was a fun conversation. Those conversations where we're not sure where we're going are pretty fun. So just for you to know, as listeners, that was a topic that we talked about, but we hadn't talked about it yet. And so we weren't really sure which way it was going to go. And actually, when we turned off the recording, we talked for, another 20 minutes or 30 minutes, kind of kicking around some ideas. And I have a suspicion that this Thursday night, we might pick it up and continue to talk about it again in person, just because it's a fascinating topic and there's a lot of different aspects to it.
Yeah, yeah. It's always fun. We will never claim to give you definitive answers on topics quite as such as this. We try to keep it practical and give practical application on Christian living, but it is interesting to kick around some of these ideas. I do think that one final thought that I had that I feel like is worth mentioning is just that I think there is something to be said for the fact that not always, but a lot of the time, even in weddings that are not between two Christians, beautiful churches are still sought after for those. And so I think that there is something to be said for still having a place that is beautiful. And I think there's a whole lot that we could potentially get into. There's a whole other can of worms about our culture's relationship with marriage. That could be another very interesting episode. We may have to revisit with Trent. But the point is, I think that's it's an interesting observation to think through and to observe how is something like a beautiful building can still serve as a witness, even if it's indirectly like something such as being used as a wedding.
I think one of our imperative callings is to celebrate beauty. And in doing so, there's an aspect of worship and celebrating beauty. It points to a perfect God who created beautiful things. And when that's reflected in architecture, no matter the size or the scope, but the level of quality and the level of attention, and the level of effort putting into beautifying something, I think is always a good sign of spiritual wholeness and wellness. And yeah, some interesting things to talk about and not necessarily a definitive answer. I think we're all still thinking through things. And like I said, probably have many conversations to come. So, however, one thing that we're pretty convinced about is that the church is important. And this would be church with a capital C, meaning God's people, the followers of Christ. And important enough that for us, what we do every day, day in, day out, our kind of day job, our passion, it's not just a day job because we're often working at nights and weekends the rest of the time too, is Unbound. And specifically, Unbound's educational programs, Equip and Explore and Ascend, are officially to train young adults how to thrive. And we certainly mean that. But not know so much unofficially, but more close to our hearts is that, you know, there's a question there, to thrive for what? And that would be to serve the church. And so at heart, what we do at Unbound is we attempt and do our best effort and put all our blood, sweat, and tears into helping young people be prepared and trained and equipped to serve the church, because we're not sure how long Unbound's going to last. Hopefully years, maybe 36 generations. Hopefully lasts me at least. But we know that there's a shelf life, that at some point Unbound will be no more. There's no guarantee of eternity for a company like Unbound. There is only a guarantee for one institution, and that's the church. And we're not talking about the buildings, but we're talking about God's people. And so when we can do work that contributes to the building up and the continuation of that, well, that's something we'd like to see continue for 36 generations, unless it's interrupted by the return of Christ himself. And if that's interesting to you, go to beunbound.us to learn more about that. And if you want to hear directly about what that might look like or might feel like or what it might be like to experience that, we'll stick around and you can hear from one of our students in this testimony that we're about to play next. Until next time, be unbound.
My name is Micaiah McClellan, and I am a Foundations alumni. That is quite a mouthful. So I did Ascend last year, and I am actually enrolled this year as a Challenge student, which is the year two program. And I'm here to tell you what the results are based off of my own experience and how I did Ascend and what that impacted and how that really honestly changed my life and the trajectory of where I was going. When I enrolled last year in Ascend, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I mean that in the best sense. I had no sense of direction. I was very lost. I didn't have a good base on which to lay a foundation on. Hence the name Foundation Student. That was not on purpose. I really didn't though. And I was very lost. And I was struggling to find a community that I wanted to be in. I never wanted to go to college. That was never something that I desired. The campus life is definitely not for me. And I just had absolutely no clue what I was going to do. I quite literally stumbled onto Unbound and I enrolled late in the semester. So I actually went to Apex, which is our first event of the year, not knowing anything about anything. And come to find out, after that week had gone by, I loved it so much that I couldn't imagine my life without these people in it. I received so much love and a sense of direction and a sense of hope. And that really gave starter to the fire of where I needed to go. I enrolled late, like I said, and I started off the year kind of understanding what I was doing. Not really. I kind of had a lot of things going on, a lot on me all at once. But it was one of the best decisions I could have made. So if you're thinking about enrolling in Ascend, I say do it. And especially if you don't actually have a direction, or if you don't even know what next year is going to look like, it is going to give you a vision for the year. It is going to give you a goal to pursue. You're going to learn so much that you can actually apply to your life. A lot of what they teach out there nowadays is garbage. You're not going to use it in real life. And the skills that you learn with Ascend are going to be impacting your life for years to come. I learned things from last semester that I still apply to this day. The leadership classes that they teach are so impactful, and I couldn't recommend it more. I know that it could be scary. For me, it was. And I pray that the Lord would guide whatever decision you're going to make. But if you're not sure what this year is going to look like, and if you need a sense of direction, and you want something that is going to challenge you, and also push you to grow closer to the Lord and give really good results, I think Ascend is an excellent option for that, and I hope that you enroll. Yeah. Bye.